On the night before the opener of deer hunting here in northern Minnesota, and kind of along that vein, we were very happy to have our next guest. Al Cambrone is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in Canoe and Kayak magazine and Sierra, the Washington Post, Meat Paper. And his latest book, Deerland, was released, I believe, last March by Lions Press. His first book, which he co-authored, is called The Deer Hunter's Guide to Processing and Preparing Venison, and that he wrote in 2009. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Al.
Well, thanks for having me on your show, Buck.
Oh, it's
great to be with you.
Really great to have and have you here. And just as a preface, you are an avid deer hunter. You live in deer country, really, in northern Wisconsin. And I want to thank you so much for writing this book. I thought I knew quite a bit about white-tailed deer, but I learned a lot reading this book, Deerland, which you did such a great job in covering kind of the full gamut of white-tailed deer in the whole United States.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, I really learned a lot myself researching it. I learned a lot of surprising things.
What I'd like to start off with first was something that opened my eyes right away when I opened your book.
Sure.
And that is just how many deer there are in the United States and how many there had been historically, how many there are now, kind of boggled my brain a little.
Right, right. We've seen some big changes. Right now, here in the U.S., we've got about 30 million deer. And that's 100 times more than we had a century ago. It's a wonderful thing to have all those deer, but it does have consequences too.
That it's just amazing that that the deer has become pretty much the predominant wildlife mammal out there in the United States, as far as larger mammals are concerned.
It has. You know, if you think about it, there's no other wild animal out there larger than maybe a skunk or a raccoon that's anywhere near so numerous and widespread.
And for most animals, we've seen a decline as far as their habitat is concerned, and it's shrinking pretty much all the time, and yet the deer is so adaptable that it doesn't seem to have any effect.
That's right. They can do well in a wide range of habitats, in some cases, deer are part of the story. You know, we love deer, and sometimes we manage and manipulate habitats for more deer. And that can mean, when we have more deer, sometimes that means less of everything else.
Yeah, and I'd like to go into that a little further in the conversation, because
it's
a big part of what I gathered out of your book that I wasn't so aware of. But another part facet about having all these deer is what a big industry that has become in so many ways, in a larger part of the economy than I realized.
Yes, yes. And you'll probably notice that over the next few days in your neighborhood, I imagine you're seeing lots of cars drive by with people wearing orange in them.
Lots of deer hunters.
Yeah, yeah. But it really is a huge industry, just massive. In fact, in Deerland, I describe it as America's deer industrial complex.
And reading the numbers that you give us in there, it's easy to see where you came up with that name.
Yeah, it's way bigger than most people realize. Here are some numbers. Typical year, about 14 million Americans go hunting. Sounds like a lot, but that's only around 6% of our adult population. And yet, they spend about $34 billion a year on hunting. And about 85% of them are hunting large game, mostly deer. So most of the money is spent on deer hunting, too. That makes it about nearly a $30 billion industry. If deer hunting, not all hunting, just deer hunting, were a single company, it would rank at just over 100 on the Fortune 500.
You know, it seems that what I think of deer hunting, and of course it probably will date me here a little bit, is that you grab your Model 94, you know, and your thermos, and if you got a box of shells with you, you go out and sit in a wooden stand somewhere and hope a deer walks by. But now technology has changed the way most people hunt. And
it really has,
what they buy.
Yes. Yeah, hunters' equipment, but also their tactics and even in their values have changed dramatically over just the last generation. I guess it's good for the outdoor industry because if you take care of it, your deer rifle might last a century. But nowadays, hunters spend most of their money on products that didn't even exist a generation ago. If you think about it, hunters need trail cams. Well, they don't need them, but we almost do. Trail cams and laser range finders, all sorts of modern gadgets.
Yeah, a GPS has just changed everything. And as you mentioned, there's so many gadgets. Just the amount of deer scent that's purchased every year is phenomenal.
Yes, yes. That was an interesting part of the story. One outdoor writer had done some rough calculations, figured that the amount of urine-based scent that hunters purchase every year would be enough to fill an Olympic-sized swimming pool, which is quite a thing to picture.
I don't know if I want to be anywhere near that swimming pool.
Yeah, but then he did some more calculating and figured out how many licensed deer farms there are in America, and he figured out how many deer there are on all those farms, and it seems pretty likely that somebody's doing some diluting out there.
You know, we pride ourselves here in the Northland with having a number of big deer taken every year. Big bucks seem to come from this area, but there's an area in Wisconsin that pretty well dwarfs what happens here.
Yes, I devoted a whole chapter to that. I'm guessing you're talking about Buffalo County?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a small county in the southwest corner of Wisconsin, but more giant deer with giant antlers have come from there than just about any other whole state in America.
And you went through a number of reasons that had been speculated over the years, and it was surprising to hear what the real reasons seemed to be.
Yeah, you know, there are all sorts of theories that you'll hear if you go to some of those taverns in Buffalo County, you know, even like the deer are bigger and stronger from going up and down all those hills. But wouldn't they be more tired out, you'd think? And it turns out the real reason, I suspected this, so I talked with a soil scientist, and I learned that the real reason for all those trophy deer in Buffalo County is soil that has just the right combination of calcium and magnesium. It's the soil itself. So the answer is very simple, but then the consequences for the people in Buffalo County were more complicated, and it really affected not just hunting, but everybody in the county. So it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it seems like real estate went through the roof.
Yes, yes. People buying that land just for hunting.
And farmers that quit farming and even switched to deer browse.
Yep. They could do better. They made more money from their farm by leasing out the land to hunters, just the hunting rights, and they'd still keep farming the land down in the bottom of the valley where it was flat, and they made some money off that, but not nearly as much as they did leasing the rights to hunt those untillable oak ridges on top that before had been pretty much worthless.
Now that people are pretty well on to the reason those deer get so big, and I think you said limestone and magnesium combination.
Yeah.
Do you find that? I know people put salt licks out, they put mineral blocks out for deer. Are those mineral blocks trying to replicate that kind of a ratio?
Exactly. In places like Buffalo County and other areas with similar geology, deer get those minerals in everything they eat. But you can try and replicate that by putting those mineral blocks out in the woods, and that's also going to attract deer. That's another reason hunters do it. And that'll help, but it's not the same as having those same nutrients in every bite deer take from every plant.
Yeah, it's quite a surprising thing to think about. You wouldn't assume that would be the reason, but it's good to have that out. We don't have to listen to everything that comes from the barstool of biologists then.
Right, right.
And I think that's part of your book later on. But we're kind of moving into something that I really wanted to talk about tonight with you, and that's because it seems so counterintuitive, and that's the results of deer feeding.
You know, a lot of people, hunters, like to leave out corn as bait, but a lot of people who aren't hunters, they love to feed deer basically for the same reason. They want to see more deer, and can't blame them for that. And some people really have good intentions. They want to help those deer through a tough winter, but it turns out, counterintuitively, like you say, that does deer more harm than good.
And that's something I'd like you to flesh out a little bit for our folks. You know, as I said, it's counterintuitive. People love to do it, and it seems to be bad enough for the environment that we'd like to get that story out more.
Sure, sure. First, let's talk about why deer don't need it. You know, it's easy to imagine if we were deer having to sleep out in the snow, we would just love for somebody to give us some corn and have more energy and be warmer. But a deer's metabolic strategy is different. In the wintertime, it conserves energy, tries to move less, lives off stored fat, and looks for thermal cover, like under conifers. If it has to go out to get feed, move through the cold, and be more vulnerable to predators getting hit by cars, just metabolically, it's going to be in the cold and maybe not get as much energy from that corn as it expended going to and from the feeder. But more importantly, it can be really tough on a deer. There are three types of what biologists lump together as corn toxicity. They're called acidosis, enterotoxemia, and aflatoxin. First, acidosis. When deer switch from a normal diet to one that's low in fiber and high in carbohydrates, it takes them as long as 3 or 4 weeks to adjust. Eventually it may, but until then, deer have a really tough time digesting that corn. That's what we'll usually be feeding them. And its digestive system gets more acid. That kills the bacteria that help with digestion. The deer get diarrhea, dehydration. They'll be sometimes laying down, staggering, or standing quietly. They may go hide when they're sick, and they may even die. We don't see it happen. An animal, when it's sick, its natural instinct is to go off and hide somewhere. So then the second sort of situation is less common, but more often fatal. Sometimes it's in combination with acidosis. The second type is called enterotoxemia. It's a type of bacteria in the deer's lower digestive tract, and those numbers of that bacteria spike when the carbohydrates go through undigested. So similar symptoms, diarrhea, frothing at the mouth, and deer's just going to be real low on energy. It's very debilitating. The last one is called aflatoxin. It's a kind of mold, and it's not the mold itself that's toxic, but some of its byproducts. It's deadly in concentrations so small that they're measured in parts per billion, not per million, but per billion. It's regulated by the FDA in food intended for humans and even for livestock. But deer corn isn't regulated in the same way. And I'm suspicious that sometimes feed that doesn't pass the aflatoxin test ends up as deer corn.
So those are ways that that corn can be deadly to deer, more or less.
Yes, yes.
How about things like a concentration of animals?
Well, that can be a problem, too, spreading other types of diseases that are contagious, infectious diseases. Things like bovine TB, CWD, that sort of thing.
A couple of things we find here, and I believe I read about these in your book as well, is that that movement of deer and car traffic don't go so well together.
No, no. If you want to know where somebody's feeding deer, you know, you could ask around, ask your neighbors, you could ask the game warden, or you could ask somebody who works at the body shop. They'll be able to tell you.
And also in our part of the world, and I believe Wisconsin is getting more and more wolves there as well, is these concentrations in the winter can lead to more wolf kills.
Yeah, the deer would be more vulnerable then if they're all concentrated in one small area.
Are there positives about feeding deer corn in the winter?
No, I can't really think of any.
Okay.
You know, people love to see deer, and they may appreciate deer more if they see deer more, but they won't be seeing normal, natural deer behaviors. So as much as they might love nature and want to learn about deer, they won't be seeing normal deer behavior. They'll see a lot of competition and aggression. So I don't know. It's hard for me to say much positive about recreational deer feeding.
A lot of your book is devoted to the environmental and biological consequences of so many deer out in our woods and even in our suburbs, but particularly in what happens to plant life out there. Can you hit on that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. A really big untold story. It's complicated, and in nature everything is connected, but here's the short version. Deer are good at two things, eating and making more deer. And every single deer eats around 3,000 pounds of vegetation per year. So clearly it won't take too many deer per square mile before things can start getting out of whack.
And what happens when they have their favorite browse?
Yeah.
What happens when this occurs?
Well, you'll see a couple of signs. First, if you're in the woods where there are too many deer, you can look down and see that the forest understory is thin. Maybe it's completely missing. You might look up. If deer are really hungry, you'll see a browse line marks the highest level that deer can reach. Sometimes if they're really hungry, when they're standing a little bit on their hind legs. And it is more complicated. As you noted, deer are preferential browsers. They like some plants more than others. So a forest with too many deer will have fewer plants, but also different plants. And then the effects of that ripple on through the whole ecosystem and affect every plant, animal, and bird out there.
Yeah, and particularly, as I understand it, it can really damage the nesting area for birds and change what birds are going to be in that area.
Right, exactly.
Now, of course, you are an avid deer hunter, as I glean from your website, and of course, most people here, a lot of people here are deer hunters. We love to have deer in our environment. Is there a balance that can be achieved, or does the political situations and problems that you brought out in your book make it difficult to find?
There is a balance that's possible, and don't get me wrong, the right number of deer, a normal natural number of deer, great, but it's definitely possible to have too many, and how many is too many, that's the question, and it depends, of course, on exactly where you're at. It depends on the habitat, but it also depends on who you ask, and some hunters want to see more deer every time they head out into the woods. Some people might like to see more balance and see other wildlife flourish too. So it's not easy finding that balance.
And it seems, from what I've noticed, that sometimes you get a little healthier, larger deer with a less stressed population.
That's true, and that's a good argument to use with hunters, and more hunters are becoming aware of this idea that the deer densities, when they're too high, yeah, you'll see more deer, but every one of those deer is going to be a little smaller, maybe less healthy. If it's a buck, maybe less likely to grow really big antlers. So maybe if we can use that ulterior motive for hunters, that'll help.
Al, I had, of course, a lot more questions. You cover a lot of territory in your book, Deerland, but we're running short of time. Can you tell folks, first of all, where you're, is there a website that they can learn more about this topic that you have?
There is, and I don't know, maybe later you can put a link on your website, but
sure.
It's alcambrone.com, or you can just search for the name of the book. It's Deerland, all one word, and you'll find it.
And you'll find that book in neighborhood bookstores. You'll find it also, I'm assuming, in of course, the big, larger book carriers.
Yes, you can find it online at big chain bookstores and at independent bookstores, too.
And your last name, could you spell it for folks?
Sure, that's Cambronne.
Great. You know, it's really been fun to talk to you, Al, and also a lot of fun for me and a great learning experience to read your book, Deerland.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And I'm sure happy you gave us this time tonight.
Well, thanks a lot, Buck, for having me on your show.